Well, the last section about the Wilson condensation cloud, and I apologize to those people who are listening by tape for not warning you before concluding the last side, but I didn't want to run out of tape in the middle of this discussion. The discussion of the Wilson condensation cloud also, I think, pretty much speaks for itself. It's produced by the lowering of temperatures below the original temperature by the rarefaction following the compression of the explosion. That causes the water to condense, forming the cloud. Vogel hypothesizes here that that is the smoke ring observed at Port Chicago. Now, remember that William J. Parsons, who was the fellow who drew up almost all of the vast bulk of the memoranda, the 400 to 600 pages of paperwork at the Los Alamos and Manhattan Project are in their files concerning Port Chicago, was the fellow who developed the U-235 gun weapon. He also was the bombing officer on board the Enola Gay, which dropped the Hiroshima bomb. He later was pivotally involved in the setting up of the Bikini tests. So again, I think the continuity here of naval testing from Port Chicago to Bikini should perhaps be considered here. The next section of physical evidence here cited by Vogel is called the seismographic record. And again, I should indicate that I don't have the technical expertise to evaluate most of the physical evidence that Vogel lays out here. I will say that I personally, as a layman, as someone without the expertise required to do so, found not this piece of evidence concerning the Wilson condensation cloud, although it is compelling, but the discussions concerning the actual force of the blast itself to be the most compelling piece of physical evidence, at least to the untrained observer. Continuing with the seismographic record. Following the Port Chicago explosion, a team of Los Alamos laboratory scientists made an assessment of the Port Chicago explosion. The team interviewed University of California at Berkeley professor Perry Byerly, B-Y-E-R-L-Y, who was the leading seismographic expert in the area. Specifically, Dr. Maurice M. Shapiro and Naval Ensign George T. Reynolds of the laboratories conferred with Professor Byerly. In his report on the seismic evidence, Reynolds, among other things, reported that the S waves, shear waves, were not clearly defined. At the time of the disaster at Port Chicago, there were many conflicting reports concerning the number of explosions which actually did occur. These conflicting reports have been a source of confusion which has tended to mask the fact that there was but a single explosion. In my opinion, all reports of more than one explosion are accounted for by blast reflections, especially from the hills which separate Port Chicago from the town of Concord. The report of Lieutenant Phillips and the seismic record indicate that there was only one explosion. The seismic record also demonstrates that the explosion and propagation of earth shock was that of a microseconds nuclear fission explosion, rather than the relatively longer explosion process and propagation of earth shock associated with the detonation of conventional high explosives. The most definitive analysis of the seismic record of the explosion at Port Chicago was published in the October 1946 issue of the Bulletin of the Seismographic Society of America by Perry Byerly. He wrote, quote, "On studying the seismograms, I found that they appeared to be the record of one shock, as far as I could determine," unquote. The Port Chicago blast registered as a 3.4 earthquake on the Richter scale. Byerly further determined that, based on the work he had done in interpreting the seismic record of the detonation of 90,000 pounds of Judson 10% blasting powder in a quarry in Richmond, California, near Berkeley, that the earth shock generated by the Port Chicago blast indicated that 10 to the 16th ergs had gone into ground shock. There are a number of problems with Professor Byerly's paper which arise from his attempt to make his recorded data fit the official figures, which indicate the Port Chicago explosion involved 1,780 tons of high explosives. Report that the Byerly test was on 45 tons of 10% blasting powder. Vogel goes on, "But it is apparent from the seismic record that the front-end characteristics of the blast, the speed of the detonation as evidenced by the character of the P, pressure, and S waves, do not match the front-end characteristics of the detonation of relatively slow, conventional high explosives. Those readers interested in reviewing the records upon which this interpretation is based may consult Byerly's paper, The Seismic Waves from the Port Chicago Explosion, in the Bulletin, which are reproduced, Those readers interested in reviewing the records upon which this interpretation is based may consult Byerly's paper, The Seismic Waves from the Port Chicago Explosion, in the Bulletin, where are reproduced all the pertinent seismograms. The three physical characteristics of the Port Chicago blast which have been discussed, the white flash, the Wilson condensation cloud, and the seismographic record, seem to demonstrate that a nuclear fission weapon was detonated there. Bearing in mind that a document exists which characterizes the formation of the ball of fire at Port Chicago as typical of nuclear detonations, there are a number of additional evidences which, though less certain, tend to corroborate this hypothesis. Well, again, I can't evaluate the seismographic data because, again, I'm not a seismologist and the information is not reproduced here, but I think this is something which obviously needs to be looked into. One of the most intriguing pieces of information cited by Vogel concerns the existence of what appears to be a motion picture of the Port Chicago explosion. The next section of Vogel's article discusses the motion picture footage. There exists a single motion picture film print in possession of the U.S. Navy Concord Weapon Station, which includes Port Chicago, which may be an authentic film record of the explosion at Port Chicago. The Navy has claimed that the film is not an authentic record of that explosion, but is instead a film of a miniature explosion created by a Hollywood studio. According to the Navy, the film was created to support their argument to the U.S. Congress sometime in the 1960s that the remains of the town of Port Chicago be purchased and incorporated into the Concord Naval Weapon Station as a buffer zone in the event of another large explosion. Significantly, the Navy did not claim the film was a recreation until after I suggested that the film could be the record of a nuclear detonation. At the same time, however, I was told by Dan Tikalski, public affairs chief at Concord, that the film was a nitrate-based film, which would require that the film had been produced prior to 1950, when nitrate-based film was replaced with non-explosive cellulose-based film. If it is ever possible to examine the original film print, the date of production will be established by reference to film type and imprinted processing dates. Based on viewing an edited video copy of that film, which was made available to me, I have concluded that the film records in every detail the progression of the actual explosion of July 17, 1944, at Port Chicago. For example, early frames of the film suggest a record of the expansion of the Wilson condensation cloud during which the formation of the ball of fire is obscured. Furthermore, the movements exhibited by several large, independent fragments of the explosion over time compared to the speed of the explosion itself are evidence of the very large distances those fragments traveled during the course of the film sequence. The still photograph from the film, which is reproduced here, see photo, exhibits a beautifully formed isothermal sphere, such as that mentioned in the history of the 10,000-ton gadget. This shot, as is true of the entire film sequence when it is stop-framed, is about as typical of a nuclear fission detonation as any textbook illustration. It is obvious, of course, that only an intentional film record of the blast could have been made, since the probability of having, by chance, a motion picture camera rolling and pointed in the right direction at the right time at night is exceedingly remote. If the explosion was filmed at the Port Chicago site, it would follow that the explosion was planned and anticipated. And again, the fact that the Navy misrepresented the facts concerning this film, maintaining that it was made in the 60s, whereas the nitrate-based film indicated production prior to 1950, is worth taking into account, much as the Department of Defense's dissemination, or perhaps Department of Energy's dissemination concerning the amount of fissionable material, of specifically the amount of U-235 available at the time in 1944. Recall that whereas they said there wasn't enough fissionable material at the time of the Hiroshima test for a test and the Hiroshima bomb, in fact, there was more than enough by the end of 1943, as we've seen. The next section here, which again, to my layman's eyes and ears and mind, is the single most compelling piece of evidence, not the information about the Wilson condensation cloud or the seismographic evidence, but rather the actual explosive force of the blast. It appears, at least to my mind, absolutely conclusive that the amount of material blasted away underneath the E.A. Bryan by the Port Chicago explosion was much, much greater than the 1.78 kilotons of conventional explosives on board could possibly have been produced. In a section called The Explosive Force of the Blast, which I find very compelling, Vogel writes, "There is little doubt in my mind that the explosive force of the Port Chicago blast greatly exceeded the potential explosive force of the conventional high explosives, which, according to public records, were loaded aboard the Bryan or on the pier. According to public records, the TNT equivalent of the total high explosives aboard the Bryan and on the pier did not exceed 1,780 tons, of which a substantial portion most probably burned and did not, in the jargon of explosive experts, go off high order, that is, explode in one powerful blast. When the Bryan disappeared at Port Chicago, a crater was formed in the river bottom. The dimensions of that crater give a fairly good indication of the size of the detonation. According to the nuclear bomb effects calculator developed by the Lovelace Biomedical and Environmental Research Institute in Albuquerque, the detonation of a 5-kiloton nuclear device on the surface of wet soil will produce a crater 53 feet deep and 132 feet in diameter. Again, this is 5 kilotons on the surface of wet soil. 53 feet deep, 132 feet in diameter. We're dealing on the E.A. Bryan with 1.78 kilotons of conventional explosives, which a portion of which probably burned and did not go off, quote, high order, unquote. Shortly after the disaster at Port Chicago, Navy divers found the crater in the river bottom to be 66 feet deep, 300 feet wide, and 700 feet long. Other measurements made between November of 1944 and March of 1945 determined a maximum depth of 31 feet and, quote, possibly 800 feet in diameter measured from the center of the blast. According to Technical Report No. 6, Army-Navy Explosive Safety Board, the Port Chicago explosion of the 17th of July, 1944. If it is taken into account that a large portion of the downward force of the blast was expanded in the creation of a large tidal wave which swept the Sassoon Bay, and if additional energy was expended in removing vast tons of soft river mud before the crater itself was formed in the rock-like hardpan of the river bottom, and if further allowance is made for the energy expended in lifting half a cubic mile of river water 10,000 feet into the air, then the total explosive force at Port Chicago may have substantially exceeded 5 kilotons. Well, I don't know whether it substantially exceeded 5 kilotons, but it appears pretty clear that it substantially exceeded the 1,780 tons which were on the E.A. Bryan. It seems almost impossible that that amount of conventional explosives, and again, 5 kilotons on wet soil without the attenuating effects of the water, the muck on the river bottom, and the ship itself, 53 feet deep, 132 feet in diameter. Later measurements, the more conservative measurements issued up by the armed forces, 31 feet deep, 800 feet in diameter, in the rock itself, underneath the Port Chicago blast. And in my mind, again, as a layman, this is the single most conclusive piece of physical evidence. It doesn't seem in any way possible that that explosion could have been anything but a nuclear explosion. Again, there are the two missing cars at Los Alamos, but the number, it's clear from the manifest records that the number of cars which were unloaded and which produced to put the 1,780 tons on board the E.A. Bryan was enormous. Two more carloads, more or less, would not have made a significant difference. Maybe put it up to an even 1.8 kilotons. But how many tons of TNT can you fit in two boxcars? Certainly not enough to account for the huge discrepancies. Particularly if not all of the explosives went off high order, quote unquote. Certainly the 31 feet deep, 800 feet in diameter, given all of the other barriers to the explosive force, rules out the possibility of a conventional explosion under the circumstances. Again, 1.8 kilotons roughly, which a portion of which probably did not go off. Continuing with this section. Most of the structural damage which occurred on the Port Chicago installation and in the surrounding territory is very nearly equal to the structural damage reported at the same distances from ground zero at Hiroshima. There are, it must be noted, some differences between the effects of the two explosions. At Hiroshima, there was intense thermal radiation, which at Port Chicago was attenuated by the shielding effects of the steel-hulled ship and the low yield of the device. The massive destruction of Hiroshima by fire is more readily accounted for by fires which were ignited from ruptured natural gas distribution lines, which were not in place at the Port Chicago facility, than by ignition from thermal radiation. Additionally, the weapon detonated in the atmosphere at Hiroshima created a complex pattern of overpressures and peak pressures, augmented by reflected pressure waves which are not characteristic of surface detonations. However, when all parameters of the blast are tabulated, earth shock, structural damage, cratering, pressure, and tidal wave in the bay, etc., the cumulative effect could possibly be accounted for by the surface detonation of a weapon of the same yield which was detonated in the atmosphere 1,000 feet above Hiroshima, or a 10,000-ton gadget. And again, to my mind, the enormous discrepancy between the cratering underneath the E.A. Bryan that would have been produced by 1.8 kilotons of conventional explosives and the massive, massive cratering produced rules out, at least to this layman, the possibility that it could have been anything but a nuclear explosion. That it appears to have been at least, the explosive force appears to have been at least two or three times what could be accounted for by the conventional explosions, even if all of them did go off, quote, in high order. Another interesting hypothesis here, one line of speculation that Vogel looks at, is the unusually high incidence of post-fallout exposure illnesses in the Port Chicago area. And in a section called Post-Radiation Effects, he writes, morbidity statistics compiled by the state of California show a pronounced increase in the statistical incidence of characteristic post-fallout exposure illnesses in the Port Chicago area and downwind, commencing in 1969 and 70, which corresponds with the generally acknowledged period intervening between radioactive fallout exposure and manifest morbidity. A recent acknowledgement of the unusual cancer rate in Contra Costa County was cited in the New York Times March 28, 1982, page 15. The presence of industrial sources of carcinogenic pollutants in the area and the effects of cigarette smoking on the population cannot be easily separated from the possible effects of fallout exposure. However, a surface detonation of a nuclear device in the circumstances which obtained at Port Chicago is conducive to high levels of local radioactive fallout, since radioactive weapon debris and fission byproducts will coalesce with salt particles present in the brackish Suisun Bay waters which were vaporized and raised in the mushroom cloud. When the salt and radioactive material-laden water cools and condenses, it rapidly precipitates. According to coded pilot balloon data supplied from the archives of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, at the time of the explosion, the wind at 15,000 feet was blowing direction 08, 16 point south, velocity 16 miles per second. The ceiling was measured, the velocity dash 16 MPS. The ceiling was measured at 11,000 feet and broken. Again, whether or not the high incidence of cancer and other post-fallout exposure illnesses is in fact due to the nuclear detonation or the probable nuclear detonation at Port Chicago, I can't comment on that authoritatively. There are other sources, as he indicates, of carcinogenic pollutants in the area, but it certainly is something which needs to be looked into. As we like to say on this program, food for thought and grounds for further research. The next section that Vogel goes into here concerns his hypotheses concerning the personnel who were on hand at Port Chicago, and he feels that they were there deliberately in order to test the effects of using a weapon like this on military personnel. The next section is called The Mutiny. There were over 1,000 surviving personnel at the Port Chicago facility after the 1944 disaster. They were mostly black enlisted men, and those survivors were protected from the effects of initial radiation by virtue of being 1.5 miles from the explosion in the base barracks and administration area. In Parsons' third preliminary report to Admiral Purnell, Parsons states that the surviving military personnel rallied quickly, unquote, to render aid to the injured and to secure the base. The psychological and morale effects of such a large explosion were of interest to the military, who desired to know whether surviving troops would continue to fight or lay down their arms in surrender. Although the surviving black men at Port Chicago rallied quickly to aid their fallen brothers, they subsequently refused en masse to again approach the task of loading ammunition aboard ships. The mutiny and trial which followed the disaster are detailed in this issue by Robert L. Allen. And obviously this is hypothetical too, but it's interesting to contemplate. And one wonders, it's interesting to reflect on this against the background of, say, the King Alfred plan and other things we've talked about on this program. Again, these were black sailors, and this is certainly that's why this particular article appeared in the Black Scholar. Now Vogel's conclusion, and I think Vogel's conclusion is pretty apparent by this stage. I'm going to read it to you here anyway. The evidence and discussion presented in this article strongly indicate that a nuclear fission device was intentionally detonated at Port Chicago in 1944. My research revealed that the U.S. had sufficient purified U-235 to produce such a device, and the technical design details were specified as early as February of 1944. Thus, it was possible to actually build a U-235 gun bomb in early 1944, contrary to previously accepted accounts. The physical characteristic of the explosion at Port Chicago, the white flash, the Wilson condensation cloud or smoke ring, the extraordinary explosive force of the blast as indicated by the crater it created, and the seismographic record showing a single microsecond detonation, all bear the signature of a nuclear detonation. Other evidence includes the unusual cancer rate in Contra Costa County, which could be due to fallout, the missing records of the contents of two railroad boxcars, which could have been used to transport the two components of a nuclear fission device, and the fascination which the Port Chicago disaster held for researchers at Los Alamos, as indicated by the extensive body of data on Port Chicago that was collected at Los Alamos. Finally, if the film footage of the explosion is an actual record of the blast at Port Chicago, then this would be strong evidence that the blast was planned and anticipated. To conclusively establish the nature of the disaster that occurred at Port Chicago would require access to data and records that are presently unavailable. However, the evidence presented here cannot be dismissed, and it is to be hoped that further investigation will reveal the full truth about an event that was the most awesome and deadly home front disaster of World War II. That concludes this article. We're going to take, again, another short musical break, and then I'm going to sum up and recap what we've looked at, because this is obviously a very involved argument. After that, we should have time for phone calls for those of you who are listening to this program live. The last section of the broadcast this evening is going to be a recap and a summary of what we've taken a look at. We've been taking a look at, obviously, a very thought-provoking and very controversial article which appeared in the Black Scholar, Volume 13, Numbers 2 and 3, from the spring of 1982, The Last Wave from Port Chicago, by Peter Vogel. His hypothesis is that the explosion of the ammunition ship E.A. Bryan on July 17th of 1944 was not, in fact, the explosion of conventional explosives, but a deliberate test by the U.S. military of the U-235 gun weapon dropped on Hiroshima a little more than a year later, and he cites a number of different things backing up his hypothesis. We began by taking a look at his discovery of the history of the 10,000-ton gadget, which bears a striking similarity to documents drawn up by the Group 05 and later renamed T-7, headed up by Joseph Hirschfelder. He essentially, that is to say Peter Vogel, after discovering the reference in the 10,000-ton gadget to a ball of fire mushrooming out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion, undertakes to answer three questions. One, did the U.S. in fact have the capability to build a nuclear fission weapon as early as July of 1944, and was there sufficient U-235 available? As we've seen, the answer was yes. Had the bomb been specified by July of 1944, that is, were the technical details of its design drawn up in final form by that time? The answer again is yes. Just as there were 74 kilograms of fissionable U-235 available by the end of 1943, 15.5 kilograms being needed for minimum critical mass, 45 to 60 kilograms to be used in the Hiroshima bomb, the military's contention that there was not enough U-235 on hand to permit a test, and the Hiroshima bomb obviously goes out the window. The specifications for the gun bomb were developed by February of 1944. By March of 44, three of them were on order. Then last, he asks, was there any evidence that the Port Chicago explosion was nuclear in origin? Obviously, he cites a number of pieces of physical evidence pointing in that direction. We next took a look again at the similarity between the history of 10,000-ton gadget with its very significant Port Chicago, typical Port Chicago fashion reference to a nuclear explosion, compared that with the Group 05, renamed T-7 in November of 1944, headed up by Joseph Hirschfelder. Recall August 1st of 1944, Port Chicago having happened on July 17th of 44, the Los Alamos Laboratories reorganized to move away from the U-235 gun weapon to the plutonium-239 implosion weapon, which could not have been, it was not developed by the time of the Port Chicago explosion. Next, we took a look at Vogel's investigation into the amount of fissionable material available, as he got the declassified documents indicating, again, by the end of 43, there were 74 kilograms of enriched U-235 available. That obviously was more than enough for a Hiroshima bomb or several minimum-yield devices. We also took a look at the relative secrecy around the release of the data concerning the availability at that time of U-235. We then took a look at Vogel's examination of whether or not the specifications for the U-235 gun weapon were developed by July of 44. They were developed by February of 44, and three of the naval guns were on order by March of 1944. We took a look, too, at the statement by Dr. Carson Mark of the Los Alamos Laboratory that the specifications for the gun weapon were virtually unchanged from February of 44 to August of 45 on the Hiroshima delivery. We took a look at how the original proposal for delivering an atomic bomb was by ship to a harbor facility, this proposed by Albert Einstein as early as 1939, and as we saw from the allocation of the jurisdiction for the development of the gun bomb to the Navy, as well as the fact that no conventional bomber could really handle a 9,000-pound load for any significant distance by mid-44, indicating that a naval delivery was more consistent. Again, the alleged detonation of the E.A. Bryan was different than most other explosions of ammunition ships, which followed prolonged fires of several hours' duration. We also took a look at a number of indications of an inordinate degree of interest on the part of the Los Alamos National Laboratory and the Manhattan Project with the Port Chicago explosion. There were 400 to 600 pages of reports and documents drawn up by Captain William J. Parsons of the Navy. Parsons was the fellow who actually designed the ordnance of the U-235 gun weapon. He was the bombing officer on board the Enola Gay. He also was one of the central figures involved in the Bikini Atoll tests, which were quite similar, according to Vogel, to many aspects of the Port Chicago explosion. Recall we dealt with that in the context of the Wilson condensation cloud, one of the characteristics of a nuclear explosion that would appear to rule out the official version of the E.A. Bryan explosion as that of a conventional as that of conventional explosives. We took a look, too, at the promotion of Commodore Parsons, his elevation to the rank of Commodore right after Port Chicago, his elevation to the rank of Rear Admiral right after Hiroshima. Interesting situation. Also, the fact that the generation of surface waves by Port Chicago were remarkably close to the hypothetical generation of surface waves drawn up in W.G. Penney's Hydrodynamic Theory of Surface Explosions. Recall that the early work on the dynamics of a nuclear explosion at the Los Alamos Laboratory related to a maritime delivery of the atomic bomb. In other words, a shipboard delivery of the atomic bomb. We also took a look at the fact that, curiously enough, among the Los Alamos records on the Port Chicago explosion were the records of two of the boxcars unloaded were missing. And again, Vogel hypothesizes that these were the two components of the U-235 weapon. The E.A. Bryan, of course, had its booms upgraded, and that he theorizes was to allow a margin of safety for the 9,000-pound load to be deposited. The 9,000-pound U-235 gun, their booms were on the E.A. Bryan were only built to a 10,000-pound maximum load specification. We took a look at a number of different pieces of physics or indications that the Port Chicago explosion could not have been conventional. First of all, the description of the white flash is characteristic of the incandescence produced by a nuclear explosion, not that of a much lower temperature conventional explosion. The Wilson condensation cloud, again, a characteristic of a nuclear explosion, pointing that in the direction of the Port Chicago explosion as a maritime nuclear test. The seismographic evidence, apparently, according to Vogel, is inconsistent with that produced by a relatively slow detonation of conventional explosives and appears to have been produced by the more quick and more powerful nuclear reaction. The fact that a motion picture record, supposedly a simulation, existed of the explosion is interesting. In fact, the most interesting aspect of it is the fact that the Navy lied about this particular film. After Vogel suggested to them that it was a record of a nuclear explosion, they said it was a Hollywood mock-up made to justify the acquisition of Port Chicago by the Concord Naval Weapons Station in the 1960s. In fact, the type of film used was produced only before 1950. So that obviously is inconsistent. The question again is, why did the Navy misrepresent that, just as the Defense Department has misrepresented the amount of U-235 available prior to August of 45? In what to me as a layman is the most compelling piece of physical evidence, the extraordinary amount of physical displacement produced by the explosion of the E.A. Bryan rules out the conventional theory. The huge amount of rock sculpted out from the bottom of Suisun Bay, recall a crater 31 feet deep, 800 feet possibly in diameter. This, after the blast went through the ship, raised a huge amount of water, 10,000 feet into the air, and then scoured out all the muck on the bottom before it scoured 31 feet deep and 800 feet wide out of the actual rock bottom of the harbor. Recall that in tests, a 5,000-ton device would have produced a crater 53 feet deep and 132 feet in diameter. There were roughly 1.8 kilotons of conventional explosives on board the E.A. Bryan. I cannot see how that possibly could have produced that huge amount of sculpting out underneath the E.A. Bryan. It appears to rule out conclusively, to my layman's eyes, the possibility of a conventional explosion. Then Vogel talks about the possibility that the high cancer rate in Contra Costa County may have been, in fact, produced by the fallout from the Port Chicago explosion. Again, I can't comment authoritatively, but I do think it should be examined. The fact that several hundred black sailors, or the fact that there were more than 1,000 personnel on hand for the Port Chicago explosion and more than 300 of them died, fits into Vogel's hypothesis because he believes that those personnel were there to test the effects of the use of this weapon on a group of military personnel, whether or not they would continue to fight or would lay down their weapons and surrender. Recall that although they initially went to the aid of those stricken in the explosion, eventually they mutinied and refused to load any more ammunition on the ships. And obviously, on the basis of this, Vogel concludes that although more research has to be done, that the Port Chicago explosion, July 17, 1944, in fact, represented a deliberate test by the U.S. military of the U-235 gun weapon, later dropped on Hiroshima, on U.S. military personnel. And obviously that has significant impact for those of us, significant portent for those of us here in the Bay Area. Who knows, it may be, again, that Brian Wilson wasn't the first person to get run over at the Concord Naval Weapons Center, or what is now the Concord Naval Weapons Station. That concludes this particular broadcast, this particular archive show.